The Life of John Knox, Volume 1, Chapter 1, being read by Peter John Parisis. Period 1, from the year 1505, in which he was born, to the year 1542, when he embraced the Reformed religion. John Knox was born in the year 1505. The place of his nativity has been disputed. It is that he was born at Gifford, G-I-F-F-O-R-D, a village in East L-O-T-H-I-A-N, has been the most prevailing opinion, but some late writers, relying upon popular tradition, have fixed his birthplace at Haddington, the principal town of the county. The house in which he is said to have been born is still shown by the inhabitants in one of the suburbs of the town, called the Gifford-Gate. This house, with some adjoining acres of land, continued to be possessed until about 50 years ago by a family of the name of Knox, who claimed affinity with the Reformer. I am inclined, however, to prefer the opinion of the oldest and most credible writers that he was born in the village of Gifford, G-I-F-F-O-R-D. Footnote, see note A, end of footnote. His father was descended from an ancient and respectable family who possessed the lands of Knock, K-N-O-C-K, Ranfurly, and Craigens, in the Shire of Renfrew. That's R-E-N-F-R-E-W. The descendants of this family have been accustomed to claim him as a cadet and to enumerate among the honors of their house that it gave birth to the Scottish Reformer, a bishop of Raphoe, R-A-P-H-O-E, and a bishop of the Isles. At what particular period his parental ancestors removed from their original seat and settled in Lothian, I have not been able to exactly ascertain. His mother's name was Sinclair. Obscurity of parentage can reflect no dishonor upon him who has raised himself to distinction by his virtues and talents. But though our Reformer's parents were neither great nor opulent, the assertion of some writers that they were in poor circumstances is contradicted by facts. Footnote, see note B, end of footnote. They were able to give their son a liberal education, which in that age was far from being common. In his youth, he was put to the grammar school of Haddington, and after he had acquired the principles of the Latin language there, his father sent him, about the year 1524, footnote, I have not been able to ascertain the precise year in which Knox entered the university, end of footnote, to the University of St. Andrews, at that time the most distinguished seminary in the kingdom. The state of learning in Scotland at that period, and the progress which it made in the subsequent part of the century, have not been examined with the attention which they deserve, and which has been bestowed on contemporary subjects of inferior importance. There were unquestionably learned Scotmen in the early part of the 16th century, but most of them owed their chief acquirements to the advantages of a foreign education. Those improvements which the revival of literature had introduced into the schools of Italy and France were long in reaching the universities of Scotland, originally formed upon their model, and when they did arrive, were regarded with suspicious eye. The principal branches cultivated in our universities were the Aristotelian philosophies, scholastic theology with canon and civil law. Even in the Dark Ages, Scotland was never altogether destitute of schools for teaching the Latin language. It is probable that these were at first attached to monasteries, and it was long a common practice among the barons to board their children with the monks for their education. When the regular clergy had degenerated and learning was no longer confined to them, grammar schools were erected in the principal towns and taught by persons who had qualified themselves for this task in the best manner that the circumstances of the country admitted. The schools of Aberdeen, Perth, Stirling, Dunbarton, Killearn, and Haddington are particularly mentioned in the writings about the beginning of the 16th century. The first two of these acquired the greatest celebrity owing to the skill of their master who presided over them. In the year 1520, James Voss, V-A-U-S, was rector of the school of Aberdeen, and is commended by Hector, B-O-E-C-E, the learned principal of the university, for his knowledge of the Latin tongue and his success in the education of the youth. At a period somewhat later, Andrew Simpson acted as master of the school of Perth, where he taught Latin with applause. From his school proceeded many of those who afterwards distinguished themselves both in church and state. He had sometimes 300 boys under his charge at one time, among whom were sons of the principal nobility and gentry. These schools afforded the means of instruction in the Latin tongue, and the knowledge of which, in some degree, was required for enabling the clergy to perform the religious service. But the Greek language, long after it had been enthusiastically studied on the continent, and after it had become a fixed branch of education in the neighboring kingdom, continued to be almost unknown in Scotland. Individuals acquired the knowledge of it abroad, but the first attempts to teach it in this country were of a private nature and exposed their patrons to the suspicion of heresy. The town of Montrose is distinguished as being the first place, as far as I have been able to discover, in which Greek was taught in Scotland, and John Erskine, E-R-S-K-I-N-E, of Dun, is entitled to the honor of being regarded as the first of his countrymen who patronized the study of the elegant and useful language. As early as the year 1534, this enlightened and public-spirited baron, on returning from his travels, brought with him a Frenchman skilled in the English tongue, whom he settled in Montrose, and upon his removal he liberally encouraged others to come from France and succeed to take his place. From this private seminary, many Greek scholars proceeded, and the knowledge of the language was gradually diffused over the kingdom. After this statement, I need scarcely add that the Oriental tongues were at that time utterly unknown in Scotland. I shall afterwards have occasion to notice the introduction of the study of Hebrew. Knox acquired the Greek language before he arrived at middle age, but we find him acknowledging as late as the year 1550 that he was ignorant of Hebrew, a defect in his education. Footnote. In the Hebrew tongue, says he, in his defense before the Bishop of Durham, I confess myself ignorant, but have as God knoweth fervent thirst to have some entrance thereon. Manuscript Letters, page 16. End of footnote. Which he extremely lamented, and which he afterwards got supplied during his exile on the continent. John, M-A-I-R, better known by his Latin name Major, was professor of philosophy and theology at St. Andrews when Knox attended the university. The minds of the young men and their future train of thinking often received an important direction from the master under whom they were educated, especially if his reputation be high. Major was at that time deemed an oracle in the sciences which he taught, and as he was the preceptor of Knox and of the celebrated schools, Buchanan, it may be proper to advert to some of his opinions. He had received the greater part of his education in France and acted for some time as a professor in the University of Paris. In this situation, he acquired a more liberal habit of thinking and expressing himself on certain subjects than was yet to be met with in his native country and in other parts of Europe. He had imbibed the sentiments concerning ecclesiastical policy maintained by John Gerson and Peter A-I-L-L-Y, who so ably defended the decrees of the Council of Constantine and the liberalities of the Gallian Church against the advocates for the uncontrollable authority of the sovereign pontiff. he taught that a general council was superior to the Pope and might judge, rebuke, restrain, and even depose him from his dignity, deny the temporal supremacy of the Bishop of Rome and his right to inaugurate or dethrone princes, maintain that ecclesiastical censors and even papal excommunications had no force if pronounced on irrelevant or invalid grounds. He held that titles were not of divine right, but merely of human appointment, censored the advocacy, ambition, and secular pomp of the court of Rome and of the ecclesiastical order, was no warm friend of the regular clergy, and advised the reduction of the monasteries and holidays. His opinions respecting civil government were an analogy of those which he held as to ecclesiastical polity. He taught that the authority of the kings and princes was originally derived from the people, that the former are not superior to the latter collectively considered, that if rulers become tyrannical or employ their power for the destruction of their subjects, they may lawfully be controlled by them, and proving incorrigible may be deposed by the community as a superior power, and that tyrants may be judicially proceeded against even by capital punishment. The affinity between these and the political principles afterwards avowed by Knox, and the defense by the classical pen of Buchanan, is too striking to require illustration. Some of these, indeed, have been taught by at least one Scottish author who flourished before the time of Major, but it is most probable that the original instructions and writings of their master first suggested to them the sentiments which they so readily adopted, and which were afterwards confirmed by mature reflection and more extensive readings, and that consequently the important changes which these contributed to accomplish should be traced in a certain measure to this distinguished professor. Nor in such circumstances could his ecclesiastical opinions fail to have a proportionate share of influence on their habits of thinking with respect to religion and the church. But, though in these respects the opinions of Major were more free and rational than those generally entertained at that time, it must be confessed that the portion of instruction which his scholars could derive from him was extremely small, if we allow his publications to be a fair specimen of his academical prelations. Many of the questions which he discusses are utterly useless and trifling, and the rest are rendered disgusting by the most servile adherency to all the minutiae of scholastic mode of reasoning. The reader of his works must be contented with painfully picking a grain of truth from a rubbish of many pages, nor will the drudgery be compensated by those discoveries of inventive genius or acute discrimination for which the writings of Aquinas and some others of that subtle school may be deserved to be consulted. Major is entitled to praise for exposing to his countrymen several of the more glaring errors and abuses of his time, but his mind was deeply tenured by suspicion, and he defended some of the absurdest tenets of popery by the most ridiculous and perilous arguments. His talents were moderate, but with the writings of the ancients, he appears to have been acquainted only through the medium of the collectors of the Middle Ages, nor does he ever hazard an opinion or pursue a speculation beyond the limits which had been marked out by some approved doctor of the Church. Add to this that his style is, to an uncommon degree, harsh and forbidding. Exile, Aridim, C-O-N-S-C-I-S-S-U-M, A-C-M-I-N-U-T-U-M. Knox and Buchanan soon became disgusted with such studies and began to seek entertainment more gratifying to their ardent and inquisitive minds. Having set out in search of knowledge, they released themselves from their trammels and overleaped the boundaries prescribed to them by their timid conductors. Each following the native bends of his genius and inclination, they separated in the prosecution of their studies. Buchanan, indulging in more exclusive range, explored the extensive fields of literature and wandered in the flowery mode of poesy, while Knox, passing through the adventures of secular learning, devoted himself to the study of divine truths and the labors of the sacred ministry. Both, however, kept uniformly in view the advancement of true liberty and religion, with the love of which they were equally smitten, and as during their lives they suffered a long and painful exile and were exposed to many dangers for adherency to this kindred cause, so their memories have not been divided in the profuse but honorable apocu, which with which they have been accursed by its enemies, and in the deserved and grateful recollection of its genuine friends. But we must not suppose that Knox was able to once to divest himself of the prejudice of the education and of the times. Barren and repulsive as these philosophical studies appear to our minds, they were something in the intricate and subtle sophistry then in vogue, calculated into fantasize the youthful and ingenious mind. It had a show of wisdom it exercised, although it did not feed the understanding. It even gave play to the imagination, while it exceedingly flattered the pride of the learned adept. Once involved in the maze labyrinth, it was no easy task to break through it and to escape into the open field of rational and free inquiry. Accordingly, Knox continued for some time captivated with these studies and prosecuted them with great success. After he was created master of arts, he taught philosophy, most probably as an assistant or private lecturer at the university. Footnote: it was not unusual in the universities at that period to select some of the students who had been lathered and made the greatest proficiency and to employ them as assistants to the professors. End of footnote. His class became celebrated, and he was considered as equaling, if not exceeding, his master in the subtleties of the Dalek art. About the same time, although he had no interest but what was procured by his own merit, he was advanced to clerical orders and was ordained a priest before he reached the age fixed by the canons of the church. This must have taken place previous to the year 1530, at which time he had arrived at his 25th year, the canonical age for receiving ordination. It was not long, however, till his studies received a new direction, which led to a complete revolution in his religious sentiments and had an important influence on the whole of his future life. Not satisfied with the excerpts of the ancient authors, which he found in the writings of the celestial divines and canonists, he resolved to have recourse to the original works. In them he found a method of investigating and communicating truth, to which he had hitherto been a stranger, and the simplicity of which recommended itself to his mind, in spite of the prejudice of education and the pride of superior attainments in his own favorite art. Among the fathers of the Christian Church, Jerome and Augustine attracted his particular attention. By the writings of the former, he was led to the Scriptures as the only pure fountain of divine truth, and instructed in the utility of studying them in the original languages. In the works of the latter, he found religious sentiments very opposite to those taught in the Romish Church, who, while she retained his name as a saint in her calendar, had banished his doctrine as heretical from her pulpits. From this time, he renounced the study of scholastic theology, and altogether not yet completely emancipated from superstition, his mind was fixed for improving the means which Providence had prepared for leading him to a fuller and more comprehensive view of the system of evangelical religion. It was about the year 1535 when this favorable change commenced, but it does not appear that he professed himself a Protestant before the year 1542. As I am now to enter upon the period of Knox's life, at which he renounced the Roman Catholic communion and commenced reformer, it may not be improper to take a survey of the state of religion of Scotland at that time. Without an adequate knowledge of this, it is impossible to form a just estimate of the necessity and importance of that reformation, in the advancement of which he labored with so great zeal, and nothing has contributed so much to give currency, among Protestants to prejudice against his character as ignorancy, or a superficial consideration of the enormous and almost incredible abuses which then prevailed in the Church. This must be my apology for a digression which might otherwise be deemed superficial or disappropriate. The corruptions by which the Christian religion was universally depraved before the Reformation had grown to a greater height in Scotland than in any other nation within the pale of the Western Church. Superstition and religious imposture in their grossest forms gained an easy admission among a rude and ignorant people. By means of these, the clergy obtained to an exorbitant degree of opulence and power, which were accompanied, as they always have been, with the corruption of their order and of the whole system of religion. The full half of the wealth of the nation belonged to the clergy, and the greater part of this was in the hands of a few of their number, who had the command of the whole body. Adherency, ambition, and the love of secular pomp reigned among the superior orders. Bishops and abbots rivaled their first nobility in magnificence and preceded them in honors. They were privy councillors and lords of sessions as well as of parliament, and had long engrossed the principal offices of state. A vacant bishopric or abbacy called forth powerful competitors who contended for it as for a principality or a petty kingdom. It was obtained by similar arts and not unfrequently taken possession of by the same weapons. Footnote. During the minority of James V, the celebrated G.A.W.I.N. Douglas was recommended by the Queen of the Archbishop of St. Andrews, but John Hepburn, prior of the regular canons, opposed the nomination and took the archiepiscopal palace by storm. Douglas afterwards laid siege to the cathedral of Dunkeld and carried it more by the thunder of his cannon than the dreads of the excommunication which he threatened to fulminate against his antagonist. BUCH period history, number 1344, SPOTTIS 61, Life of G.A.W.I.N. Douglas, prefixed to the translation of the AENEID period, Rudiman's edition. End of the footnote. Inferior benefices were openly put to sale or bestowed on the illiterate and unworthy missions of couriers or dice players, strolling bards, and the bastards of bishops. Footnote. Sir Douglas Lindsay's works by Chambers, volume 133, volume 2 to 237 and 238. End of footnote. Plurities were multiplied without bonds, and benefices given in commoden were kept vacant during the life of the commentary. Nay, sometimes during several lives, footnote, the popes were accustomed to grant liberty to the commendarians to dispose of benefices which they held by their tenure to others who should succeed to them after their death. Introduction to Scott's Biography in WODROW, Manuscript, Volume 9, page 171. End of the footnote. So that extensive parishes were frequently depraved for a long course of years of all religious service, if a deprivation it could be called deprivation, at a time when the cure of souls was no longer regarded as attracted to livings originally endowed for this purpose. The bishop never on any occasion condescended to preach. Indeed, I scarcely recollect an instance of it mentioned in history, from the erection of the regular Scottish episcopal down to the era of the Reformation. The practice had even gone to desuetude among all the secular clergy and was wholly devoted on the mendicant monks who employed it for the most missionary purposes. the lives of the clergy, exempted from secular jurisdiction and corrupted by wealth and idleness, were become a scandal to religion and an outrage and decency. While they professed chastity and prohibited, under the severest penalties, any of the ecclesiastical orders from contracting lawful wedlocks, the bishops set the example of the most shameless profligacy before the inferior clergy, avowedly kept their harlots, provided their natural sons with benefices, and gave their daughters in marriage to the sons of the nobility and principal gentry, many of whom were so mean as to contaminate the blood of their families by such base alliances for the sake of the rich dowry which they brought. Through the blind devotion and mummification of princes and nobles, monasteries, those nurseries of superstition and idleness had greatly multiplied in the nation, and though they had universally degenerated and were notoriously become the haunts of lewdness and debauchery, it was deemed impetuous and sacrilegious to reduce their number and abridge their privileges or alienate their funds. The kingdom swarmed with ignorancy, idle, luxurious monks who, like locusts, devoured the fruits of the earth and filled the air with pestilence and infection, friars, white, black, and gray, canons, regular, and of St. Anthony's, Carmelites, Dominicans, Franciscans, Jacobins, nuns of St. Augustine, St. Clair, St. Catherine of S-I-E-N-N-A, whose canonists of various clans, etc. The ignorances of the clergy respecting religion was as gross as the dissoluteness of their morals. Even bishops were not ashamed to confess that they were unacquainted with the canon of their faith and had never read any part of the sacred scripture except what they meet with in their missals. Footnote, Fox, page 1153, printed in the year 1596. End of the footnote. Under such pastors, the people perish for lack of knowledge. That book which was able to make them wise unto salvation and intended to be equally accessible to Jew and Greek, barbarian and Scythian, bond and free, was locked up from them and the use of it in their own tongue prohibited under the heaviest penalties. The religious service was mumbled over in a dead language, which many of the priests did not understand, and some of them could scarcely read, and the greatest care was taken to prevent even catechisms composed or and approved by the clergy from coming into the hands of the laity. Footnote, Wilkins, Conestilia, Tomb 472, Lord Halley's Provincial Council of the Scottish Clergy, page 36. End of the footnote. Scotland, from her local situation, had been less exposed to disturbances from the encroaching ambition, vexatious exactions, and fumigating anathemas of the Vatican court than the countries in the immediate vicinity of Rome. But from the same cause, it was more easy for the domestic clergy to keep up on the minds of the people that excessive veneration for the Holy See, which could not be long felt by those who had the opportunity of witnessing its vices in worldly politics. The burdens which attended a state of dependency upon a foreign jurisdiction were severely felt. Though the popes did not enjoy the power of presenting to the Scottish prelates, they want not numerous pretexts for interfering with them. The most important cause of a civil nature which the ecclesiastical courts had contrived to bring within their jurisdiction was frequently carried to Rome. Large sums of money were annually exported out of the kingdom for the pursuing of pals. The confirmation of benefices, the conducting of appeals, and for many other purposes, in exchange for which were received leaden bulls, wooden pals, wooden images, plenty of old bones with similar articles of precious consecrated mummery. Footnote. Notwithstanding laws repeatedly made to restrain persons from going to Rome to obtain benefices, the practice was greatly on the increase about the time of the Reformation. It is scorched time sent only benefice, the sped and Rome expect great bishoprics. But now for one unworthy vantage, a priest will ride to Rome in pilgrimage. One caval quick was never at the skull, will run to Rome and keep him bishop mule, and see him ham with money a color crack, with a burden of benefices on his back. Chambers, Lindsay, 260. End of footnote. Of the doctrine of Christianity, nothing almost remained but the name. Instead of being directed to offer up their adoration to one God, the people were taught to divide them among an innumerable company of inferior objects. A plurality of mediators shared the honor of procuring divine favor with the one mediator between God and man. The more petitions were presented to the Virgin Mary and other saints than to him who the Father always heareth. The sacrifice of the Mass was represented as procuring forgiveness of sins to the living and the dead, to the infinite disparagement of the sacrifice by which Christ Jesus expiated sin and procured everlasting redemption. And the consciences of men were withdrawn from faith in the merits of their Savior to a delusive reliance upon priestly absolutions, papal pardons, and voluntary penitence. Instead of being instructed to demonstrate the sincerity of their faith and repentancy by forsaking their sins and to testify their love to God and man by practicing the duties of morality and observing the ordinances of worship authorized by Scripture, they were taught that if they regularly said their Aves and Credos, confessed themselves to a priest, purchased a Mass, went in pilgrimage to the shrine of some celebrated saint, or performed some prescribed act of bodily mortification, if they refrained from flesh on Fridays and punctually paid their tithes and other perquisites, their salvation was infallibly secured in due time. While those who were so rich and pious as to build a chapel or an altar, or to endow it with the support of a priest to perform masses, obits, and dirges, procured a relaxation of the pains of purgatory for themselves or their relations in proportion to the extent of their liberality. It is difficult for us to conceive how empty, ridiculous, and wretched those haggards were which the monks delivered for sermons. Legendary tales concerning the founders of some religious order, his wonderful sanctity, the miracles which he performed, his combats with the devil, his watchings, fasting, flagellations, the virtues of holy water, chrisms, crossings, and exorcisms, the horrors of purgatory with the numbers released from it by the intercession of some powerful saint, these with low jets, table talk, and fireside scandal formed the favorable topics of the preacher and were served up to the people instead of pure, psalter, and sublime doctrine of the Bible. Footnote, Knox 14-16, Spottiswood 64 and 69, Keith, Appendix 205, Dale Yale's Cursory Remarks, prefixed in Scottish Poems of the Late 16th Century, I-16-18, Chambers, Lindsay, I-211, end of the footnote. The Bibles of the dying were besieged in their last moments, disturbed by a vicarious priest who labored to extort bequests to them or to the church. Not satisfied with exacting tithes from the living, a demand was made upon the dead. No sooner had a poor husbandman breathed his last than the rapacious victor came and carried off his corpse present, which he repeated as often as death visited the family. Ecclesiastical censors were fomented against those who were reluctant in making these payments or who showed themselves disobedient to the clergy, or for little money they were prostituted on the most trifling occasions. divine service was neglected, the churches were deserted, especially after the light of the Reformation had discovered abuses and pointed out a more, quote, excellent way, unquote. So that, except on a few festival days, the places of worship in many parts of the country served only as sanctuaries for malefactors, places of traffic, or resorts of past times. Footnote. Dale Yell's Cursory Remarks, UT, SUPRA, I-28. End of footnote. Persecution and the suppression of free inquiry were the only weapons by which its interested supporters were able to defend this system of corruption and imposture. Every avenue by which truth might enter was carefully guarded. Learning was branded as the parent of heresy. The most frightful pictures were drawn of those who had separated from the Romish Church and held up before the eyes of the people to deter them from imitating their example. If any person who had attained a degree of illumination amidst the general darkness began to hint dissatisfaction with the conduct of the clergy and to propose the correction of abuses, he was immediately stigmatized as a heretic, and if he did not secure his safety by flight, was immured in a dungeon or committed to the flames. When at last, in spite of all their precautions, the light which was shining around did break in and spread through the nation, they prepared to adopt the most desperate and bloody measures for its extinction. From this imperfect sketch of the state of religion in this country, we may see how false the representation is when some persons would impose on us as if popery were a system erroneous indeed, but purely speculative, superstitious but harmless, provided it had not been accidentally accompanied with intolerance and cruelty. The very reverse is the truth. It may be safely said that there is not one of its erroneous tenets or of its superstitious practices which was not either originally contrived or afterwards accommodated to advance and suppress some practical abuse, to aggrandize the ecclesiastical order, secure to them immunity from civil jurisdiction, sanctify their encroachments upon secular authorities, vindicate their usurpations upon the consciences of men, cherish implicit obedience to the directions of the church, and extinguish free inquiry and liberal silence. It was a system not more repugnant to the religion of the Bible than incomparable with the legitimate rights of princes and the independency, liberty, and prosperity of kingdoms, a system not more destructive to the souls of men than to social and domestic happiness and the principles of sound morality. Consideration from every quarter combined in calling aloud for a radical and complete reform. The exertions of all descriptions of persons of a man of letters, the patriarch, the prince, as well as the Christian, each acting in his own sphere for his own interests with the joint concurrency of all as in a common cause were urgently required for extirpating abuses of which all had reason to complain and for effectuating a revolution in the advances of which all would participate. There was, however, no reasonable prospect of accomplishing this without exposing in the first place the falsehood of those notions which have been called speculative. It was principally by means of these that superstition had established its empire over the minds of men. Behind them, the Romish ecclesiastical had entrenched themselves and defended their usurped prerogatives and possessions, and had any prince or legislator endeavored to deprive them of these, while the great body of people remaining unenlightened, it would soon have been found that the attempt was premature in itself and replete with danger to those by whom it was made. To the revival of the primitive doctrines and institutions of Christianity by the preaching and writings of the reformers, and to those controversies by which the popish errors were confuted from Scripture, from which many modern philosophers seem to have a thorough contempt, we are chiefly indebted for the overthrow of superstition, ignorancy, and despotism. And in fact, all the blessings, political and religious, which we enjoy may be traced to the Reformation from Popery. How grateful should we be to Divine Providency for this happy resolution? For those persons do but sport with their own imaginations, who flatter themselves that it must have taken place in the ordinary course of human affairs and overlook the many convincing proofs of the superintending direction of superior wisdom in the whole combination of circumstances which contributed to bring about the Reformation in this country as well as throughout Europe. How much are we indebted to those men who, under God, were the instruments in effecting it, men who cheerfully hazarded their lives to achieve a design which involved the felicity of millions unborn, who boldly attacked the system of error and corruption, though fortified by popular creditude, by custom and by laws, fenced with the most dreadful penalties, and who, having forced the stronghold of superstition and penetrated the recesses of its temple, tore aside the veil that concealed the monstrous idol which the whole world ignorantly worshipped, dissolved the magic spell by which the human mind was bound, and restored it to liberty. How criminal must those be who, setting at ease under the vines and fig trees planted by the unwearied laborers and watered by the blood of those patriots, discovered their disesteem of the invaluable privileges which they inherit, or their ignorance of the expense at which they are purchased by the most unworthy treatment of those to whom they owed them, misrepresent their actions, cumulative their motives, and cruelly loaded their memories with every aspect of abuse. The Reformed doctrine had made considerable progress in Scotland before it was embraced by Knox. Patrick Hamilton, a youth of royal lineage, footnote, his father, Sir Patrick Hamilton of Kincavil, K-I-N-C-A-V-I-L, was a son of Lord Hamilton, who married a sister of James, King, James III. His mother was a daughter of John, Duke of Albany, brother to the same monarch. Pinkerton's History of Scotland, 2, 45-6, 289, end of footnote, obtained the honor, not conferred upon many of his rank, of first announcing its glad tidings to his countrymen, and of sealing them with his blood. He was born in the year 1504, and being designed for the church by his relations, the abbacy of Ferne was conferred upon him in his childhood, according to a ridiculous custom which prevailed at that period, but as early as the year 1526, previous to the breach of Henry VIII with the Romish, see, a glimpse of light was, by some unknown means, footnote, this was an act of Parliament as early as the 17th July, 1525, prohibiting ships from bringing any books of Luther into Scotland, which had always been cleansed of all filth and vice. Act Parliamentarium Scottish, page 295. This renders it highly probable that such books had already been introduced into this country. End of the footnote. Imparted to his mind, amidst the darkness which brooded around him, his recommendations of ancient literature at the expense of the philosophy which was then taught in the schools, and the free language which he used in speaking of the creations of the church, had already drawn upon him the suspicions of the clergy, which he resolved to leave Scotland and to improve his mind by traveling to the continent. He set out with three attendants, and, attracted by the fame of Luther, repaired to Wittenberg. Lutheran and Melanchthon were highly pleased with his zeal, and after retaining him a short time with them, they recommended him to the University of Marpurg, M-A-R-P-U-R-G. This university was newly erected by that enlightened prince, Philip, Landgrave of Hesse, H-E-S-S-E, who had placed at its head the learned and pious Francis Lambert of A-V-I-G-N-O-M. Lambert, who had left his native country and sacrificed a lucrative situation from love to the Reformed religion, conceived a strong attachment to the young Scotman, who embedded his instructions with extraordinary efficacy. While he was daily advancing in acquaintance with the scriptures, Hamilton was seized with an unconquerable desire of imparting to his countrymen the knowledge which he had acquired. In vain did Lambert represent to him the dangers to which he would be exposed. His determination was fixed. In taking along with him a single attendant, he left Marburg and returned to Scotland. The clergy did not allow him long time to disassemble his opinions. Pretending to wish a free conference with him, they decoyed him to St. Andrews, where he was thrown into prison by Archbishop Beaton, and committed to the flames on the last day of February, 1528, in the 24th year of his age. At his trial, he defended his opinions with firmness, yet with great modesty, and the mildest patience and fortitude which he displayed at the stake equaled those of the first martyrs of Christianity, who expired with these words in his mouth: "How long, O Lord, shall darkness cover this realm? How long wilt thou suffer this tyranny of men? Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." The murder of Hamilton, says the historian of that period, was afterwards avenged in the blood of the nephew and the successor of the persecutor. The flames in which he expired were, in the course of one generation, to enlighten all Scotland and to consume with avenging fury the Catholic superstition, the papal power, and the prelacy itself. Pinkerton's. The good effect which resulted from the martyrdom of Hamilton very soon began to appear. Many of the learned, as well as the common people in St. Andrews, beheld with deep interest the cruel death of a person of rank, and they could not refrain from admiring the heroism with which he endured it. This excited inquiry into the opinions for which he suffered, and the result of inquiry, in many cases, was a conviction of their truth. Gawinlogie, rector of St. Leonard's College, was so successful in instilling them into the minds of the students that it became proverbial to say of any one suspected of Lutheranism that he had drunk of St. Leonard's well. Under the contrivance of John Winram, footnote, in 1546, Winram, having spoke to the bishops in favor of George Wishart, Cardinal Beaton upbraided him, saying, "Well, sir, and you, we know what a man you are 7 years ago." Piscati, 189. End of the footnote. The subpar they also secretly spread among the novice of the abbey. These sentiments were not long confined to St. Andrews, and everywhere persons were to be found who held that Patrick Hamilton had died a martyr. Alarmed at the progress of the new opinions, the clergy adopted the most rigorous measures for their extirpation. Strict inquisition was made after heretics. The flames of persecution were kindled in all quarters of the country, and from 1530 to 1540, many innocent and excellent men suffered the most inhumane death. Footnote, see note H. End of footnote. Henry Forrest, David Stratton, Norman Gourlay, that's G-O-U-R-L-A-Y, Jerome Russell, Kennedy, Killer, Beveridge, Duncan Simonson, Robert Forster, and Thomas Frost for the names of those early martyrs whose sufferings deserve a more conspicuous place that can be given to them in these pages. A few whose consistency was overcome by the horrors of the stake purchased their lives by juring their opinions. Numbers made their escape to England and the continent, among whom were the following learned men: Gawin Logie, Alexander Seton, Alexander Ayles, John McBee, John Fith, John McDowell, John McBray, George Buchanan, James Harrison, and Robert Richardson. Footnote. See note I in the footnote. Few of these exiles afterwards returned to the native country. England, Denmark, Germany, France, and even Portugal offered refuge to them, and foreign universities enjoyed the benefit of those talents which their bigoted countrymen were incapable of appreciating. To maintain their authority and to preserve those corruptions from which they derived their wealth, the clergy would willingly have driven into banishment all the learned men in the kingdom and quelled forever the light of science in Scotland. Various causes contributed to prevent these violent measures from arresting the progress of truth. Among these, the first place is unquestionably due to the circulation of the scriptures in the vulgar language. Against this, the patrons of ignorancy had endeavored to guard with the utmost jealousy. But when the desire of knowledge had once been accepted among a people, they easily contrived methods of eluding the vigilancy of those who would prevent them from gratifying it. By means of merchants who traded from England and from the continent to the ports of Leith, Dundee, and Montrose, Tyndale's translation of the scriptures, with many Protestant books, were imported. They were consigned to persons of tried principles and prudency, who circulated them in private with great industry. One copy of the Bible, or of the New Testament, supplied several families. At the dead hour at night, when others were asleep, they assembled in one house. The sacred volume was brought from its concealment, and while one read, the rest listened with mute attention. In this way, the knowledge of the Scripture was diffused at a period when it does not appear that there were any public teachers of the truth in Scotland. Nor must we overlook another means which operated very extensively in alienating the public mind from the established religion. Those who have investigated the causes which led to the Reformation on the continent have ascribed a considerable share of influence to the writings of the poets and satirists of the age. Poetry has charms for persons of every description, and in return for the pleasure which it affords them, mankind have in all ages been disposed to allow a greater liberty to poets than to any other class of writers. Strange as it may appear, the poets who flourished before the Reformation used very great freedom with the church, and there were not wanting many persons of exalted rank who encouraged them to this species of composition. The same individuals who were ready at the call of the Pope and clergy to undertake a crusade for extirpating heresy entertained poets who invaded against the abuse of the courts of Rome and lampooned the religious orders. One day they assisted at the auto de fe, in which heretics were committed to the flames for the preservation of the Catholic Church. Next day they were present at the acting of a pantomime or a play, in which the ministers of the church were held up to ridicule. Intoxicated with power and lulled asleep by indulgency, the clergy had either overlooked these attacks or treated them with contempt. It was only from experience that they learned their injurious tendency, and before they made the discovery, the practice had become so common that it could no longer be restrained. This weapon was wielded with great success by the friends of the Reformed doctrine in Scotland. Some of their number had acquired great celibacy among their countrymen as poets, and others who could not lay claim to high poetical poetry merit, possessed a particular talent for wit and humor. They employed themselves in writing satires in which the ignorance, the negligence, and the immorality of the clergy were stigmatized, and the absurdities and superstitions of the popish religion exposed to ridicule. These political infusions were easily committed to memory and were circulated without the invention of the press, which was at that time entirely under the control of the bishops. An attack still more bold was made upon the church. Dramatic compositions, partly written in the same strain, were repeatedly acted in the presence of the royal family, the nobility, the vast assemblies of people, to the great mortification and still greater disadvantage of the clergy. The bishops repeatedly procured the enactment of laws against the circulation of seditious rhymes and blasphemous ballads, but mythical epistles, moralities, and songs in the Scottish language continued to be read with evidency, notwithstanding prohibitive standards, statutes, and prosecutions. Footnote, see note K, end of footnote. In the year 1540, the Reformed doctrine could number among its converts persons of rank and external responsibility, as William, Earl of Glencornel, his son Alexander, Lord Kilmar, William, Earl of Arrow, William, Lord Raven, his daughter Lilas, married to the Master of Drummond, John Stuart, son of Lord Methven, Sir James Sandilands with his whole family, Sir David Lindsay, Erskine of Dun, Melville of Raith, Balneth of Hallhel, Stratton of Lorchiston, with William Johnston and Robert Alexander advocates. The early period at which they were enrolled as friends to the Reformation renders these names more worthy of consideration. It has often been alleged that the desire of sharing in the rich spoils of the Popish Church, together with intrigues of the court of England, engaged the Scottish nobles on the side of the Reformed religion. At a later period, there is reason to think that this allegation was not altogether groundless. But at the time of which we now speak, the prospect of overturning the established church was too distant and uncertain to indulge persons who had no higher motive than to gratify adversity, to take a step by which they exposed their lives and fortunes to the most imminent hazard, nor had the English monarch yet extended his influence in Scotland by those arts of political intrigue which he afterwards employed. During the last years of the reign of James V, the numbers of the Reformed rapidly increased. Twice did the clergy attempt to cut them off by a desperate blow. They presented to the king a list containing the names of some hundreds possessed of property and wealth, whom they announced as heretics, and endeavored to procure his consent to their condemnation by flattering him with the immense riches which would accrue to him from the forfeitures of their estates. When this proposal was first made to him, James rejected it with strong marks of displeasure. But so violent was the antipathy which he at last conceived against his nobility, and so much had he fallen under the influence of the clergy, that it is highly probable he would have yielded to the solicitation if the disgraceful issue of an expedition which they had instigated him to undertake against the English had not impaired his reason and put an end to his unhappy life on the 13th of December, 1542. End of period 1, having been read by Peter John Priestes.